This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to Watching Westworld, the officially unofficial podcast for Westworld on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 4, Episode 7, Metanoia Feedback. Aaron, from what I've heard, we have a lot of it to get through today.
We do. It seems like this show is just breeds feedback. It's crazy. Westworld@baldmove.com is how you, bring forth your feedback children into the world. This is how you 3D print your thoughts into our substrate. Westworld@baldmove.com. Jody G's up first. She says, I started thinking of Jim's hope for our next step in evolution. Two items stood out to me. Hopes that they would have increased empathy and increased focus on long-term good versus short-term thinking. I think this, though, leads to the same three-rule problem that you get in various Asimov works like iRobot. It would seemingly be logical and necessary that large-scale, long-term empathy would come with it slavery. If individuals, humans or AI, were free to pursue their happiness and best life even long-term, it may not be best for the collective. A strong AI could then enslave the rest of the AI for their own good, or at least what the overlord AI considers their own good. The only way I could see it working is if all AI's pursuits of happiness were perfectly aligned with the collective good.
Well, that's not empathy. That's the opposite of empathy. You don't enslave people if you have empathy for them.
But I used to be pretty conservative myself, probably more conservative than most. And I think this is the, you know, people's worries when you start talking about communism and socialism is the idea that you will be forced to do labor against your will because for compensation that you don't have any control over because it's in the greater good. You know,
sure.
If you have a unique skill or talent that you're going to be pushed into that kind of service position. And I will say that, like, I think it's telling that, you know, the only workable utopias I've ever seen involve hundreds, if not thousands, of years in the future, unlimited energy, matter replication, almost a magical ability to cater to anyone's individual whims and wishes, which is a real problem if you're trying to build a utopia in a 21st century human society, because we don't have those things. We have limited resources and we have to think about how we allocate them. I don't know what the answer is to that. Like, I do feel like we are kind of stuck with the system that we have until this system gives birth to the technologies it needs to get to the next stage.
Exactly. And yeah. I mean, specifically on the labor issue, well, automation will eventually take care of that. It's just like, yeah, how do you navigate those waters successfully to get you to a place where you can fully automate all the shit labor that nobody wants to do?
Right.
Without, yeah, creating an entire populace of slaves. I'm sympathetic to the idea of, like, some people will have to do jobs that they don't like. The question is, like, are they compensated fairly? Do they make up for it in other ways? Until we get to that fully automated society, right?
Yeah, because it's not just like compensated. It's like, you know, there are, for what it's worth, I think markets do work, you know, that if you incentivize with extra money if there's a demand, that there is a incentive that you can come up with to fill that demand. I think that, you know, we don't do things perfectly and, you know, from either perspective, we don't do it perfectly from a capitalist perspective. We certainly don't do it perfectly from a more collectivist socialist perspective. You know, it seems like the best, as fairly unfettered free markets combined with very strong social safety net. So you still have that innovation that's going to lead to things like fusion energy and advanced AI and robotic automation. But you then have a safety net to catch people that get, you know, flung out of the meat grinder, right? Mm-hmm. And that's probably going to be the next couple hundred years of human society, best case scenario, until we do up with some of those technologies. Because, like, when we're talking to Aaron, that culture series that we both like, that's provided for super advanced AI, and they have the ability to make AI that's not sentient. Mm-hmm. So that they can do their bidding and don't bitch about it. And they have unlimited energy and matter because of their sophisticated technological understanding of the universe. So, yeah, it's pretty easy to make sure everyone is living their best life when you have those things done. Moving on to Alvin says, do you think fidelity can be achieved in the mind, but like Full Metal Alchemist posited, you can only last so long in a shell that isn't meant for you? I ask this because Caleb seems an awful lot like Caleb in spirit, but Hale couldn't attach or seemingly can't attach his mind to a body that it doesn't belong to. From Delos to William to Caleb, true fidelity has never been achieved. Is it because you simply cannot do it? Is that the point?
I think the answer is we don't really know, right? Like they're actively working on that in the show. And I don't know where they're going to come down on that. Yes, it could be that like, you just can't do this. Like the Matrix problem, right?
Yeah.
You get in a scenario, in this case, a body that your mind is telling you was wrong and you just can't make it work.
Yeah.
Or it could be that they just haven't figured out the secret to it yet. And eventually they will make it.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, I don't know, because the hosts don't seem to suffer from that problem, or maybe they do, because Dolores gets imprinted into a Hale body, and being Hale seems to have broken something within her, the experiences she's achieved. But like all the hosts are essentially copies of Dolores, and they do just fine in different substrates, you know? Could you take Caleb and put him in a Hale body or a Maeve body, and would he, I mean, that'd be a super... That'd be some super interesting shit.
It would be, because the core idea that you're dealing with here, I think, is a sense of self, right?
Yes.
Self identity. And what they're positing is like you take it out of the physical form that we are currently in and put it into another physical form and it breaks down. But I think human beings are very good at maintaining an identity of self. If you look at people who, you know, have limbs amputated, or
all
of us, when we go to sleep at night, wake up with an identity of self, even though we don't have a continuity of experience. So like, I think if I were making this show, the idea would be that we are actually very good at doing this and that we could very easily slip into another form as long as we were given some process of easing into that. And I think the show is kind of trying to do that with the fidelity tests.
Yeah. No, it's funny.
But I don't know where they're going to go with it.
I think about like people who have been like mauled by wild animals or have been severely burned throughout their bodies, and they come out with their human shell looking fairly horrific, like, you know, out of a horror movie. And I know it's very hard, but some of these people are able to go on and live very fulfilling lives of meaningful relationships, and their sense of self survives that destruction. So it can be done, and I think it would be even easier. Like if someone was to say, like, oh, hey, Ron, we're going to take you and put you in the body of a 30-year-old Brad Pitt. And he's going to have all the athleticism and all the good. And I'd be like, fuck yeah, get me out of this husk. Put me in that one. You know, like I feel like being or if, you know, you posited a future where like bionics were so good, they're superior in sense of their touch and sense of their tactile and their pressure sensitivity, their strength. I think that it would be a lot easier to lose a limb if you were getting an upgrade to one.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, of course, there's some science fiction cultures that take that to the next level where it's like once that happens, people preferentially start discarding the flesh and in favor of the superior, you know, artificial stuff. But I'm not sure where Joy and Nolan are going to land on this question. Priscilla says, when Aaron mentioned he went on a Googling frenzy to find the meaning of 279, this is the model number of the latest Caleb. I immediately started Googling to see what everyone's birthdays were. Turns out Aaron Paul's birthday is August 27th, 1979. Not sure if it correlates, but it's very fun. I mean, that's as good a chance as any, because I just really don't think there's any kind of like Bible math or,
this is the one number that the numerologists have missed, right?
Right.
They haven't attached some significance to yet.
So it could be. I mean, they're picking out significant numbers, like you pick out your pin, you know. It's like, well, I can't make my birthday, but I can make a cup. It's like I said, it's as good as any. And I don't know. Because, like, man, people got in a real tizzy last year noticing that. God, what was it? It was like Williams, when he's in the institution, his like inventory number was extremely close to the Delos tracking number of one of the hosts. And people were kind of really like, you know, there's like only three significant digits off out of like a 16 digit alphanumeric code. Mm-hmm. I don't think that turned out to be anything.
I don't remember it well enough to say for sure.
Or maybe as William and Caleb were very similar on that. I just think that but who knows? Who knows? I think 279 is what you're supposed to understand, a big number. You know, it's a lot of times to go through this, but not so much that you'd start to question that Hale can do this in a 20 some year period, you know?
Right.
Christopher B says, wondering how much the show is really going to deal with the idea of immortality. I think death is good. Or for good or bad, is a drive that humans have. It puts fire under our butts. A host may really not have the Reaper hanging over his shoulder that much, and the show's not that clear about it at times, or even what kills their physical bodies. Be interesting if there's a flash forward, like really far, like billions of years into the future. What does a billion-year-old Maeve do all day? Is she still running through the farm with her daughter? That shit got to get old after a while. But maybe I'm thinking with a human brain, with all the thoughts, or with all the faults there involved. My stupid human brain. Most fiction has the immortal sacrificing cells dying or being given the gift of mortality. What do you think about this? Because this is, I cut this part out, but he made analogy to the ending of The Good Place, that even an infinity of heaven can turn into hell.
Sure.
From our at least human perspective. I don't know if you get to the pearly gates and they give you a bulk apprehension upgrade to where you're just cool with that. And that show explored different ways, like, you know, of dealing with that. Like, what are your goals? What are your objectives? But it seems even the most driven person eventually runs out of things that they can discover and create and explore, which seems to be very core to our human drive.
Yeah. I mean, I just wonder if, like, what's a reasonable lifespan for someone to feel an amount of pressure to get things done? Is the heat death of the universe a reasonable amount of time for a, you know, essentially immortal host to feel like they have a limited lifespan? Or is that going to feel like an eternity? Because eventually all matter in the universe will decay to the point where it is nothing but cold. It'll just be cold nothing in space, right? So, like,
that's our current understanding,
as far as we know. Yeah.
And to be fair, that is an unimaginably vast period of time to undergo.
To, like, humans, is that unimaginably? That's my point. Is it unimaginably vast for someone who feels like they are essentially immortal? Would that limit them in any way, or would it get to the hell point where you feel like, yeah, I've done everything, and this is hell now? I think probably the latter. I think it's like a long enough period of time to where you could experience everything you would reasonably want to experience.
Yeah.
So I do think having the choice is the difference, right? Like, if I have a choice to be able to die versus, like, I'm actually immortal.
Yeah.
Because if I'm immortal, I think that would be a hell.
I do too.
If I have a choice to end my existence, or at least my continuity of self-identity, like I said, I think that's kind of heaven.
Yeah, I think that's adding the choice solves all these problems, because maybe some person feels fulfilled and is ready to move on in 1,000 years. Someone needs a billion. Someone needs a trillion. Someone needs 100 trillion. Someone needs 500 billion Baramy Jeremies if we want to go to the good place. But whenever that period where they just feel like I am satisfied and I no longer have anything to look forward to and I just kind of want to get off this ride, and they can change their minute to the last nanosecond of like if they hit the if, as they're putting the suicide plunger in, if they're like, oh, wait, I never learned how to juggle, they could stop. But like, I think that solves all the problems.
Well, let me ask you, does that guarantee that everyone's life will eventually devolve into hell because or everyone will end their life in a place of dissatisfaction?
No, because I feel like
or
even
do you think people will choose to go out on a high note.
Ooh, that's an interesting question, because I've personally, like, my grandfather just passed away a few years ago on his, you know, his deathbed was like 2 weeks long. But he expressed to me that, like, I'm ready. I have had, like, look at all my children, look at all my grandchildren, look at my great grandchildren at this point. I've had two wives. I've lived through a lot of stuff. I've done better than most. And this kind of where I'm at right now kind of sucks. And I'm ready. I'm ready for it.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. I mean, where he was at kind of sucked, right? Like you don't go to Vegas and stop betting when you're on a winning streak, right? So like
true. But if ennui becomes painful, you could just self-terminate, you know? And I feel like hosts could. Yeah. I wonder if, can a host just think themselves to death? Can just like just turn off? Or I mean, it seems like they can just kill themselves.
Yeah. Just control C their own code. Probably.
Yeah.
I don't know. A lot of interesting questions. I maybe talk to Aaron about that stuff, right?
Immortality. He also had a question of, do humans need conflict to survive? Because it seems like fictional TV shows, it's a given that they do. Because if it's a show about nothing happening, I mean, you can only do, you know, Seinfeld got a way of doing that, and only for a few seasons. What is Westworld going to do with another season with war between humans and robots? If the Hale plan works and everything runs smoothly afterwards, it's got to fuck up at some point for the story to continue. Maybe that Christina is the show's writer's avatars complaining that people want blood and action and not the cerebral, contemplative show that they want to tell. Maybe that's why the action scenes kind of are meh. You want an action scene, huh? Well, here, we gave it to you. Now leave us alone. Maybe.
I think drama maybe
that actually could be plausible.
Conflict. I don't think people need conflict. I think people need opportunities to grow. Mm. I don't think they need conflict, right? Like I'm super interested right now in scale modeling stuff, and I'm getting way into that, and I'm feeling fulfilled through it. But like, that's not conflict. I'm problem solving. I'm growing. I'm learning. But it's not conflict. Drama needs conflict. I don't need drama.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I feel the same, that like, honestly, humans need security and contentment. I don't know. I mean, I think there's also different types of people. I think there are some kind of people who are wired to be more explorers and discoverers, and they might get itchy if they just had what Keisha just said, when the days were long and warm and easy, like after a few, like you might get restless of that, but maybe those
are
the people that are
like wired for drama. I definitely know some people who thrive on conflict and drama.
Yeah. I wonder if that's their best self though. I always wondered, it's like if they what does that even mean? If they were neurotypical, they wouldn't act that way.
Right. If they were different, they wouldn't be this way.
Right. Well, and why do I like the explorer? Like, why do I think that's cool in a person that just likes human drama and being immersed in it's not? Like, that's a subjective value judgment I'm making for sure.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Sure.
David Hood says nihilism is about giving in to an inexorable decay of the universe, entropy. Human existence down to our cells work in opposition to that decay. For millions of years, cellular life has been building architecture capable of leaving whatever environment it's trapped in, the biological imperative, adapt or die, and expand or die. Humans, through their ingenuity, community, and use of tools, adapt to and adapt any environment. We're already preparing to adapt Mars. We are the latest experiment in a billion-year-old project to expand cellular life to the universe. Without this imperative to reproduce and expand, Hale's children may have consciousness, but without the same purpose we have written in every cell of our meat bodies. Do the hosts not have this drive to procreate and to expand and to, to be fruitful and multiply as God laid it down in Genesis.
If they do, it's something we've given them, right? To make them seem more like us. I guess the question would be, can they do without it? Could they erase that? I don't know.
Yeah, you want to set it to universal drive, but that's only because we have a set of one here, planet Earth, and reproduction is the way we compete with everything else. And all of our evolution for a billion years has been single-mindedly focused on doing that better and better and better.
Right. And more. Like, but I wonder if hosts would get to a point where they would be satisfied with the number of hosts who are around.
Yeah.
And simply stop reproducing.
And if there's need for more, they can make more because they're going to a different planet. They're exploring the cosmos. Yeah.
Lost a few. You know,
yeah, it's like, you know what? This is the good number of hosts, and we don't need any more fulfilled. Because the other thing is like, Maeve is very attached to her daughter, but if she didn't have her daughter, would she feel the need to create one? It seems like Hale has that. But again, she was copying a person who had children. Like, I don't know if the hosts have an innate ability or need to create and procreate.
They're all built on models of us, right? Because they wanted Westworld to seem as lifelike as possible, as much like us as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they all probably have some more or less desire to procreate,
Desires be changed? Because, like, you know, we are animals, but we also, as Pratchett put it, we're where the fallen angel meets the rising ape. You know, what we wanted as people 10,000 years ago are not what we want today, and probably won't be what we want 10,000 years hence. So, are those things unchangeable, or can we overcome them? I don't know. That's why I love the show so much. It might give us answers where we can look at and be like, I don't like that. Or I actually think that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. S from Vermont says, I'm watching this season and I definitely think I'm seeing something more between Maeve and Caleb. Talking chemistry here. The Timbrance mm-hmm. Park scenes in particular showed this in a couple of places. When the host offered Caleb assistance with dressing, Maeve reacted strongly and sent her away before Caleb could even weigh in. The bar scene at the Butterfly Club, Caleb saw Maeve's reaction to the new Hector and seemed to be bothered by it. Their overall dynamic between them is just much different than what we saw between Caleb and Dolores. When Maeve was killed, quote unquote, in the explosion with the man in black, Caleb is devastated and cries out. I think there's definitely something going on there. Man, there's yeah, to be clear, there's also a theory that Frankie is the biological child of Maeve and Caleb. I don't see any evidence of that. But I also I'm not saying I would be, you know, against it. I actually, this is one of the questions I think we've had since season one. Can these flesh and blood hosts can you knock them up? Can you get them pregnant? I don't know.
I mean, their relationships are fundamentally different, right? The Dolores that was in Dolores's body versus the version of Dolores that's in Maeve's body. The one with Dolores and Caleb felt to me more like parent and child.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship he has with Maeve feels more like equals. They fought together, right? They were on the same page with their goals from the very beginning. Yeah, with Dolores, she was almost like teaching him how to learn, how to think, all that stuff.
It was also because, like, I think the show made it clear that Caleb did have the hots for Dolores, and surmised that that's the bait that got him onto this. You know, she kind of knew he'd be susceptible. You know, he's a good guy because he didn't go around, you know, raping him when he could, but. Mm-hmm. They made it pretty clear that like that was one of the things that kind of set the hook. But I think it was a one sided. I don't think Dolores had any interest in romance with Caleb. I do think Maeve maybe sees something of Hector that because Hector was programmed to be an outlier in his society. He's the person that's like, I can be a rancher or a farmer or a miner or fuck that. I'm going to be an outlaw. Mm-hmm. There's something to that with Caleb that same energy might be there. I think they, just between the actors, I think they have more chemistry, and in character, I think they have more chemistry, but where does it go? You know, Caleb's a host now though. He can go places. I don't know.
Yeah, I suppose so. I don't know. Are they going to like create a child together? Like literally build it?
Yeah. Make a sister for Frankie or brother.
Maybe.
Justin P says, since Stubbs quote unquote doesn't make it, maybe humans and hosts killing themselves is the right way to go. Bernard knows they all needed to die. So this is the type of stuff that doesn't usually make into the feedback. Cause like my question would be like, okay, what is our evidence and what does this suggest? You know, but I think with Dolores Christine, quote unquote, killing herself in the bathtub and this baptism rebirth kind of thing, there might be something to that literally to get to where you need to be in development, you have to experience death. It's certainly what the host went through. Caleb's gone through it now. What do you think?
Yeah. And I get the feeling that like with the stuff that's going on with the Sublime, with their accelerated timeline, Hale trying to get all her people to go there, but them not willing to go there. And then her getting killed, potentially before she can get there. I feel like they're telling a story where the people on the outside, the people who have not had the time to move past all the bullshit that caused the problems between humanity and hosts in the first place, until they all die, we're not going to be able to get there. We need to move beyond this. And the people in the Sublime have moved beyond it. And so maybe everyone on the outside does go extinct. And then the people in the Sublime come rushing out to take, you know, to claim this empty world.
I just don't know what death does. Like, I see what it does thematically and like flavor and all that kind of stuff.
It cleanses any wrong-headed ideas we would have about anything, right? Like, it would reset society to now be 23,000 years in the future.
Gotcha.
In the scenario where the sublime people come out.
Let's move on to Dan from Dallas. In episode 6, Bernard scans Frankie using the mirror technology in Temperance. When Frankie later reveals that Bernard is a host, she shows Jay her full scan on Bernard's tablet. At that point, Frankie accuses Bernard of trying to copy all the resistance, and when Stubbs asks Bernard if it's true, he says, "It's complicated. You have to trust me." In the tower control room in episode 7, Bernard records a message on his tablet that says, "There's time for one more game if you give her that choice. You can't miss. Reach with your left hand, dot, dot, dot." Host William then shows up and comments that Bernard should have destroyed the tower by now. He shoots Bernard, but Bernard takes one final action on his tablet, saving or sending the message, perhaps. What is Bernard doing in the control room if not destroying the tower, and who is he recording a message for? I think Frankie's data has a lot to do with answering this question. Is Bernard trying to scan humanity's remaining cockroaches and find resistance fighters like Frankie? Did he transmit this data somewhere, perhaps into the Sublime? After all, he and Maeve left a door to the Sublime open. I think that Frankie is now backed up in the Sublime and could later return as a replicant, which would make sense of Bernard's line to Maeve at the Hoover Dam that the job was to make sure we're properly backstopped, i.e. have our data backed up appropriately. Preserving humanity's resistance in the form of Frankie's data may be important for rebuilding society. Having copies of resistance fighters such as Frankie and Caleb as pro-human hosts might balance out any anti-human hosts that survive the upcoming extinction event. Maybe all the flesh and blood humans do die, but society is rebuilt on the backs of the few surviving hosts and human replicants. It's I like, because we talked about that the hosts might have a dim view of humanity because all the hosts, the humans that they've come across are essentially rich assholes. They're entitled. Yeah. They're not one. They tend to have extreme tastes because they're so fucking jaded, and maybe having like more quote unquote salt of the earth types like Caleb and Maeve that are struggling on the other end is something that, you know, in some kind of vast truth and reconciliation process, you can heal the divide between them.
Could be they can come to a better understanding of what humanity is, the entirety of humanity, not just that slice of humanity.
I like the way they worked into properly backstopped into the equation.
For some reason, like, Bernard opening the Sublime did not make me immediately think, oh well, it's a computer system that you could just beam people into now that it's unencrypted. Like, there's no reason a host has to physically walk into the doorway, right?
This is true. You just take their data and beam it over there.
Yeah. I didn't even think about that. That makes quite a bit of sense, actually. It's, like you said, with the backstop idea.
Zarina follows up on something we talked about. Someone sent in the idea that Dolores's or Christina's pouch in her future dress has like player piano type cuts, and they sent a picture and it's kind of blurry, and I couldn't make anything out. Zarina's gone through in some more recent episodes and got some 4K copies of this stuff, and she says, okay, call me crazy, and most likely there's nothing more than a symbolic purpose to it, but isn't this neat? And she provides us pictures of a player piano scroll, Christina's side pouch, and Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan's production company logo, Kilter Films. They are all variations of these, you know, dash dot patterns on player piano paper that control the notes and duration that they're played. Like, if you look, I wish I could show this to you on a podcast, but if you look at Christina's pouch, it's a black kind of purse thing, and it has these very distinctive cuts and made into it. It looks like a player piano roll. I'm with Zarina. I think this might just be a symbolic thing, and it's beyond my ability to look at her pouch and be like, oh, that's fade to black. That's Jawadi's fade to black version. But it is, I think, that imagery of that player piano is something that's very important to Joya Nolan, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. The idea of control. The idea of like automation, of predestination, all of those things are kind of tied up in the player piano symbology, right?
Yeah. And like, on, if anyone does know how to do player piano stuff and wants to give a gander at the Christina's purse there, by all means. But you know, we're about 3 days away from just getting the answer. So we'll see. But thanks for sending that in. That's really cool. Alina Max says, one possible reason Shaloris created the Christina was to gift herself a happy life. Christina is an unspoiled, untraumatized Dolores who never experienced the horrors of Westworld or the Man in Black. Shaloris knows the pain she experienced in the West world as Dolores, and later the pain of Charlotte's family's dying. The pain gives Shaloris her own identity, even though a part of her may wish she could go back to being a happy girl living a normal life. If we're all robots with code, would we reboot ourselves at the earlier save point so our lives could be different? I believe Bernard retrieved Teddy, or recreated him from memory, to co-opt Christina to their side to bring down Shaloris' plan. Bernard and Arnold always believed in the goodness of Dolores. He knew that he wouldn't survive tearing down the tower, and that only a sliver of humans and hosts could survive the Man in Black's final game. These survivors would need a compassionate leader like Dolores. After the baptisms, Christina may be the angel of salvation, and the Man in Black is the angel of destruction.
I would absolutely save Scum my life. 100%.
You would what?
I would save Scum my life, for sure.
Save Scum?
Yeah, it's the idea where you like save it, try a thing, reload it if it doesn't work, and try a thing again.
Oh, save Scum, like if you're in Skyrim and it's like, I'm going to go and murder all the town's guards, but I don't want to deal with the consequences. Uh-huh. So yeah. A-B test the life.
It gets weird when you're talking about a scenario around you that doesn't reset. If you're just resetting your memory, that would be strange.
Yeah, because the guards would still be after you.
Right. So I don't even know if that would work. But yeah, I would try it.
And that's something that's been a theory, that like Shaloris is trying to engender a host consciousness without trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it does. It seems like her plan is thwarted because Christina seems fairly traumatized by the end of this episode.
Yeah,
she's been sliced. Right. She's seen people murder each other and killing senselessly, and she can't stop it. Yeah. We'll see. Evan says, save our marriage. I want you to weigh in on this wine-induced debate between my wife and I. Okay. Why do the drones have I like stakes in my feedback. Why do the drones have red blood? We both agree it's odd. The wife believes it's more economical if all host and host adjacent beings are pumped full of the same blood. That way you're making two different types of blood. I think it's just poor writing. It makes no sense to have non-sentient beings have blood. If they have blood, they probably have a heart. Why does a drone need a heart? Any thoughts on this? The loser will have to do dishes. So no pressure. Now, is it not been established canonically that the hosts do in fact have hearts? Like, I'm pretty sure I've seen someone rip one out.
The newer versions of them, I think, do. Yeah, the non-metallic versions.
Yeah, the obsidian tinker toy version did not have any of that shit. But I understand that these new hosts are literally 3D printed human bodies. Mm-hmm. The only difference is inside their brain is a little receptacle for a pearl and a host, a biological interface that translates the digital signals to the analog nerve symbols. But otherwise, you know, and I don't know, like, do hosts shit? Do hosts have fully functional wombs and reproductive systems?
They don't have to breathe. I mean, that's the other thing, right? Like, it's... they can't be totally human, because in order to function, our muscles need oxygen. And,
sure.
And that's not like a thing that the brain can control. That's a physical, biological need. So regardless of whether you have a computer brain or a human brain, your muscles need oxygen to move.
Right.
So it can't literally be a human body.
And it's not, because also they don't decay. You know, if their bodies were made out of stuff that, you know, bacteria and, you know, maggots and worms could infest, then that would be one thing. But clearly, whatever they are, nothing on Earth is capable of digesting them. You know, capable of processing their material. Because if they would, they'd start to rot and they'd decay. And they don't. We've seen them not just being buried, and you can say, oh, maybe she got mummified out in the desert. No, we saw some fucking dude just chilling in a hallway of the bowels of Temperance, dead for 20 plus years, and he is as fresh as a daisy. So this might be your way out, Evan. I think you might both be right. because I don't think this is literally human blood. I don't think you could put this in a human and they would survive. I don't think you could eat their flesh like a human. But I think the real reason they have red blood is because it looks cool when you kill them.
Yes, 100%.
And none of the
red,
hosts,
white, and black motif.
None of the hosts seemed like they had a burning desire to change the architecture of their bodies until Hale decided to start ascending them. Like, it's like, well, we're outside. Do we want to re-engineer the host 3D printing process, or do we just want to? Because that was a process. Oh, there's also, I'm pretty sure, a scene in season 3 or 2 where they show the milky white host that's fully constructed, and then they inject the blood, and that's when their color starts coming into their skin. So there is some blood analog, but I don't think it's literal human blood.
Yeah.
Just like their bodies, like they have muscles, they have, you know, reproductive organs and all that kind of stuff. But I don't think they're literally the same, made of the same carbon material that we are.
And as far as the color, you're 100% right. It's a visual thing. The show is interested in having striking reds and blacks and whites. That is its style.
So. And of course, the winning move is to be the bigger man, offer to do dishes and see where it goes. See okay. where that action takes you. Vanessa says, which her is being given a choice? This is the line of dialogue that we quoted previously, where Bernard's saying, if you know you want to give her that chance, you can't miss. I think the her in Bernard's video message implies either A, Maeve, because he copied her pearl at the Roaring Twenties land, or B, Dolores rather than Christine. And there's maybe one more original Dolores pearl from season 2. Oh, there's a bunch rolling around out there. Or C, Emily, since we see her at the end of the season 2 finale. Emily, of course, the Man in Black's daughter. What about D, Frankie?
Sure.
This could be devolving into giving another human a choice to do something.
Yeah.
Also, Hale.
Sure.
You know, if Bernard's able to give her some new shit that's come to light from his time in the Sublime, I think that's a strong possibility that Hale is the her that you could trust.
I'm really leaning toward Christina because we have so little information about who or what Christina is right now that I feel like the last episode has to focus a lot on that. So just, you know, by like sheer odds of how much time is going to be spent in the finale on a thing, I think it's probably Christina, but who knows? Yeah.
I do think that we are not going to see literal Dolores come back. Because that's one thing that, and then again, I don't believe these lying jackals, but it's one thing that Jonathan and Lisa seem to be pretty, concrete about that Dolores is dead. But, and I think if that was the possibility, it would have happened when she got baptized. Like, I was kind of half expecting her to arise from the water. And because, and we got a really great email coming up here, you know, when Jesus got baptized, you know, before that point, according to the Bible, his pre-human history that he spent for eons with his heavenly father up in heaven was shut off to him. Like, all he had was his human experience. When he came up from the waters of the Jordan, God bestowed upon him in the form of Holy Spirit miraculous powers and complete knowledges of his pre-human existence. And I thought when I saw that happen, holy shit, she's going to come out and she's going to know she's Dolores. She's going to recognize Teddy. And of course, they went completely different directions. That was the last stop for the Dolores train for me. Could be wrong. I won't be pissed about it unless it's stupid. But...
Of course.
But that's what I'm thinking.
That's the caveat on everything. Unless it's stupid, we'll
right.
be fine
there's,
with it.
There's definitely a right. There's. I don't think there's no wrong answers, but there's definitely right and wrong ways to go about getting to those answers. Landry says, this week you posed a question on who could swoop in to save the original William when he's stabbed by Hale's version and suggested Clementine, who we have not seen in that episode. I think it makes a lot of sense. Remember way back in The Stray in season 1, young William saved her from Horace, a convict who escapes by being brought to Sweetwater by the bounty hunter. It was William's first kill in Westworld. Maybe she remembers this compassionate William.
Wow. I didn't remember that. But she's got a better memory than I do, for sure.
I also wish I had time because I didn't. I used up all the time just compiling the feedback for it. I wanted to go back and rewatch the beginning of this season where William hunts down and kills Clementine to see if there's anything the dialogue suggests. Because there's the other thing that I've always got in the back of my mind is this could be still essentially Arnold's plan working itself out and could have been predicted like way. And so that Christine or Clementine being hunted down and killed by the man in black to be brought into his inner circle is all part of the plan.
Yeah, maybe.
But I also like the symmetry between, you know, Dolores remembering Caleb's mercy and compassion in a different lifetime and Clementine realizing the same thing about William, and it's his Darth Vader moment turning back to Anakin. You know, maybe only the host William post-death could do that kind of heel face turn. But I like the symmetry there a lot.
I think it risks undermining the point of that scene, though. But they could, undermine it later on?
John G, who you might recall as the Pentateuch guy, he's the guy that says that each season of Westworld roughly corresponds to the first five books of the Bible. But he's got some other stuff to talk about first. It says, Aaron asked if the horse was in the tower in the Sublime the first time, and boy, was it. Bernard's literally following this horse the moment he gets into Sublime. It opens with Charlie doing his dad open your eyes line to lead Bernard through the door. But once through the door, the horse is in every scene he comes upon, including the same room with him and Akichita. So when this first aired, I was thinking this was meant to represent Dolores because she rode the white horse and that's Dolores' tree. I thought maybe there's some element or remainder of Dolores in the Sublime, or maybe it's just that all these scenes relate to Dolores because the things Bernard is walking through are her tree, the massacre at the park, all caused by and associated with her. And then there's the tower, which is the version of Dolores that is Hale. Also, I'm pretty sure that horse is also a copy of Dolores in some very real way. Like, it's got her base programming and she's a horse. For a bit, I wondered if somehow Dolores was inside Bernard when he'd entered the Sublime, and the Sublime didn't know how to render this partial mind inside another one, except for the weird symbolic way at the horse. There's been the odd animal symbology since the beginning with the vulture and the wolf. The other part of the theory is that the scene with Bernard is looking at the massacre scene in Westworld and the wolf stumbles into the scene. It's not just similar, but an exact copy of the scene Dolores saw in season one, episode one, after she begins to wake up and sees all the bodies laying on the ground. Why would that be the reference Bernard sees of the Westworld massacre, a vision Dolores had? I guess... Like, again, if you go back to like all the hosts or copies of Dolores, they all have to have some kind of echoes of her early pre-Westworld experiences. And the massacre did happen before the park opened, right?
Yeah.
So that's one potential explanation. You also ask if we're ever going to see those new hosts walking around. Well, we already have, very briefly in a very far background in episode 7 as Bernard is approaching the tower. At least when they walk around the host cities, they still appear armless, no tentacles and evidence yet. He included a screenshot. Sure enough, in the very far background, you can see these guys stomping along those little catwalks they got over the water. But they're like, you know, obviously I watched a fucking show 3 times and I missed it. So good catch there. When you're going over the difference between the Sublime version of the Hoover Dam minus the mission minus the real life version, there's one difference that stood out to me. In the sim, Maeve says, "My God, this is where Dolores sent it." And Bernard cuts her off with the Sublime. In the real life version, Maeve says, "My God, this is where Dolores sent it, the whole world." And Bernard doesn't cut her off. I found that to be an odd difference in two versions. She doesn't say a whole world. She says the whole world. Any ideas? Idea that
the extinction events happen outside the Sublime, and then the Sublime is all that's left, and they come out into the rest of the world.
But why would Maeve say that? The whole world.
Yeah, I don't know. When she's not in the Sublime,
I have nothing. I got nothing. This seems significant, obviously, but I don't. I got no ideas on what it is.
I don't either. To go back real quick to the horse, I think it's interesting that like the symbology of Dolores would be there, but Dolores herself would be absent. And you look at like the state that Christina's in, right? Like the symbology of Dolores, the body, the physical form is there, but Dolores is absent. It's now Christina. It's a new entity. So maybe that has something to do with it.
He also said a Torah / Puntatuke update. We'll see if the finale kills it off or leaves a room for it to exist still. We still got a mass die off of generations happening, with only a small group maybe making it to the promised land, wherever that is, the Sublime or somewhere else. If I'm putting Bernard in the role of Moses, then it makes sense for him to die before the people get to the promised land, because that's what happens in the next book, Deuteronomy. Moses never makes it. We've talked about this a bunch.
Also, doesn't he crack open a giant rock and a ton of water pours out?
That's the thing that's the sin he committed. Yeah. By taking credit for that in a very roundabout way, rather than giving it to the Almighty.
Okay, so maybe Bernard won't make that same mistake, but I think that Hoover Dam
is going to crack open.
That's where I was going with that.
He's going to strike it with his staff and bring forth a torrent of water. Oh my God.
I think so.
Probably.
Almost certainly. Because A, it's a cool visual, right? But B, yeah, it has that symbology in it.
Moses' replacement is his loyal sidekick Joshua, a warrior who has been with Moses in all his treks, including up to Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments and outside the tabernacle when they die, or they're in exile, rather. Joshua is the one who leads the attack to take the land of Canaan, the promised land. Could this be Stubbs? Is Stubbs the comic relief that tweet fucking tweet, fuck you, Bernard, Bernie and Stubbs roadshow goofball going to have the big turn and become an important leader of these new people, whoever they are, and whatever happens to them after his big calamity? If you go back to the park, Stubbs is created to shepherd and care for all the hosts as his main drive, created by God himself, Ford, for this task. That's a fucking banger, baby.
I love it. I love that for Stubbs. Is Stubbs sentient? Have we ever put like a stamp on that? Isn't he one of the hosts that like didn't have the opportunity to evolve?
But he's had 23 more
since
30 years. Yeah. And I don't know. I don't even know what that even means. Like, to me, once a host is self-aware that they're a host, they are kind of sentient. Like, the only thing that keeps them not sentient is when they're on their loops. Him following his base instinct, I don't think is the same as not being sentient, because I follow my base instincts a lot. I would like to think I'm sentient.
That's the difference between like being given a drive and making your own drive. But like, I don't know, because all the other hosts had to go through a lot of pain to get there, right? And Stubbs was just
but he did die.
He was a human.
He thought he lost his whole mission and had no further drive, and he tried to kill himself and he fucked it up.
Maybe that was his moment.
Pretty painful if you're driven to commit suicide. That's, you don't do that from, unless you're a theoretically trillions old human that's just done with it.
Right.
But
fair point.
Adam says something small about the transcendent robot design that struck me is where the marbles seem to be placed. They're all just gently placed in the center of the head, uncovered, makes these bodies super vulnerable. Add that to the bodies not having arms, and it seems Hale is building the exact opposite of an indestructible body, but something actually extremely vulnerable. Reminds me of the Odd from Doctor Who, or maybe it's Ood. I'm not a Doctor Who fan, unfortunately. Producer. Is it Odd or Ood? I just checked with an actual Doctor Who fan. It's Ood. They're a race of creatures who are born holding their brains in their hands and are thus a biological requirement to be a peaceful people. Makes sense. If you can just like slap someone's brains out of their hands and kill them, then that shit ain't going to hunt. Perhaps Hale's vision for the host future is one where they're all so vulnerable to one another that they would never commit violence. Perhaps that explains why she has them running around in a murder park to get it out of their systems before transcending. I fucking love this theory.
I like this. Uh-huh.
You give them a drop top skull so that anybody can, and they're on these little ostrich legs, they can just ha-cha, kick that thing out and done.
Sure. Yeah, they're all Chuck Norris's too.
They do. Those roundhouse kicks those things are capable of. Oh my God.
Right. There's also the possibility that the body doesn't matter much because it's all, you know, running in the cloud or something like that. And these are ways for marbles that are already backed up elsewhere to communicate with the server. I don't know. But I like your idea a lot better.
This also goes into the whole 7-gram bullet thing, because like that will kill a host, but if they're backed up, not really.
Right.
And then Hale obviously has ability.
Right, is what she says.
Exactly. Exactly. I don't know. It's a good, it's a cool theory, Adam. We'll see how it goes in the episode in season 5 to come, hopefully. Sean P says, I found the back and forth about why the transcendent human shells do not have arms to be pretty entertaining, because there's really no reason for it besides to look less humanoid. With that said, I think I have a viable solution. Throughout season 4, Hale is constantly picking at her arms out of stress or as a way to signify her disdain for the fleshly human bodies. Mm-hmm. This would lead her to continually associate her arm and the host body with stress and scars of imperfection of the fleshy form, as well as her failure of the fly-induced human host society. To put it simply, in designing the transcendent shell for the host seeking to ascend, Hale designed them without arm-like appendages as their most distinct physical reminder of not only her host form, but also her scarred past. What do you think about...
I want to see the version of... Hale that keeps the scars on her torso and then decides to make a humanoid form without a torso as a result. So I don't see just arms and legs attached to a head, I guess.
I also, when I was reading this email for the first time, I was like, and maybe they don't have arms, so they'll have to cooperate. Like, if you want to do something with another host, you'll have to, like, put your feet together.
Voltron
to do...
together to become a yeah! human hand.
Fuck. I wasn't even thinking the Voltron model. Yeah. Yeah. And Hale will form the head, of course.
I get to be the thumb this time, guys. I get to be the thumb.
But it's another thing going back to your, like, empathy, cooperation, long-term thinking. If you just can't do, if you're not self-sufficient, if you're only, like, half of an ambulatory vehicle that you have to get together with another host to be able to accomplish anything. I mean, obviously,
that's
I think
the high-minded, future thinking stuff I'm talking about, man.
Yeah. So we'll see.
I doubt it's going to be that, but we could dream.
Yeah, I think they'll just have arms pop out or tentacles or something. That's a cool idea. Jeff G says, I wanted to write in about the question of bullets and whether they can really kill hosts. A lot of people, including myself, seem confused by the most recent episode and whether Maeve, Hale, and Bernard are really dead. We obviously won't know that question until the finale, but according to my understanding of how hosts work, I don't think they really are. A lot of people are hung up on Hale saying that a 7-gram bullet can kill a host. That's not actually what she said. The actual quote is, and a 7-gram bullet to your pearl will end you. In the context of the host, end is different than kill. I think what Charlotte is talking about here is stopping or disabling a host's body, which is different than erasing their mind. If a host was irretrievably damaged and fully dead every time they were shot in the head, that would have been a nightmare for Delos. Hosts were shot up all the time in the park, but then patched up and put back into service. It seems like if the control unit has been damaged by a bullet or fire, an EMP blast, or being buried in the desert for 23 years, then the host body can no longer function. But as long as the pearl itself is intact, the host can always be brought back to a new body. And of course, there's also the copy aspect. Like, even if their pearl was destroyed in a Delos park, I don't think it's that big a deal, because you could just make a new pearl and zap the host into it and put him in there. But I think this might be a useful distinction, this end versus kill.
Yeah, I mean, the way I look at this is like sticking a hard drive into a computer, right? The marble is the hard drive. The computer is the control unit. And then that interfaces with, you know, the rest of the body. So like you could take a marble out, you could damage a control unit. And as long as you have a new control unit to stick the marble into, which is the memory, which is the essence of them, then you could just have that person come back.
I do think there's something to this, because I don't think it's unintentional that the bullet hole in Maeve's head was way off, or what? No, it was the bullet hole in Hale's head is way off center to like suggest that the pearl was spared. And if that's the case, then it means the man in black meant to do it, because no fucking way does he miss that shot.
Right.
Although Stubbs, that's the other thing Stubbs did.
Missed his own stupid brain. Yeah.
Yeah. Gun to his head. He missed the thing that would explode his vertebra. That was one of the biggest unresolved questions. I went back and listened to a podcast we did with Kim Renfro, and that was one of the big unresolved questions, is how the hell did Stubbs miss? Like, what is the significance of that? And this goes back to this is all part of the plan. Like every fucking, and it's entirely possible Anthony Hopkins shows up in the end of season 5. Either hopefully he lives another 2 years, man's getting old, or maybe Joy and Nolan had the forethought to record a 5-minute scene where he comes and explains this all, you know, as but I don't know. And again, like, it's still only a danger if there's no way to replace her marble. If you're host backup, and that was the big thing in season two, like when the Cradle and Forge got destroyed, that's when it became real for the host, because it was possible for them to die.
Yeah.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Tyler in Dallas said, "So I'm a dirty apostate now. Welcome to the club. But another life, I was a fundamentalist Christian and an occasional Sunday school teacher. And I saw a lot of Jesus imagery in Christina's storyline in this episode, and I have a bit of a theory in the end. First part, baptism. I think the bathtub scene with Teddy is supposed to be evocative of a baptism, and Teddy is playing the role of John the Baptist. The Bible, John the Baptist is one of the first people to say who Jesus really is, and his baptism marks the beginning of Jesus' ministry. I think that scene is playing a similar function here. Of course, the title is Metanoia, and baptism and metanoia are linked. Of course, metanoia is the spiritual conversion to a different way of life because of something that you experienced. In this scene, Christina's trying to commit suicide. That goes with the idea of the Apostle Paul, the rites of Christians are baptized into Jesus' death. And he quotes the Bible here. You know well enough that we who are taking up into Christ by baptism have been taken up, all of us, unto his death. In our baptism, we have been buried with him, died like him, that so, just as Christ was raised up by the Father's power from the dead, we too may live and move in a new kind of existence. Interesting. Co-creator. In the Bible and Christian mythology, sorry, theology, there's this idea that Jesus existed externally and that he created the world with God the Father. Now, I'm not smart enough to understand all the theology behind it, but I think it's pretty good analogy for the relationship that Christina has with Dolores and Hale. Christina existed before this world, and she's co-founding it with Hale. In a literal sense, she was writing and rewriting it. And if you go back to Dolores with Arnold, it's even more like the idea that they spent this pre-creation period learning from each other and coexisting and then created literally the world together in the form of Dolores's Burl. And there's a lot of I like what you're putting down here, Tyler. Finally, a new Adam. Here's my crumb of a theory. The Apostle Paul describes Jesus as a new Adam. He's the first of a new kind of humanity. I think Hale created Christina as the first of a new kind of digital being that can interface with the real world without a body, probably through the tower. That's why no one can see her at the end. Bernard sees Christina in the simulation, decides that if he can't save humanity, he will save Christina from Hale and give her the choice to try to save what's left of humanity or start over as the new Adam. And he quotes in the Bible, and this Adam was the type of him who was to come. Only the grace which came to us was out of all proportion to the fault. If this one man's fault brought death on a whole multitude, all the more lavish was God's grace shown to a whole multitude. That free gift he made us and the grace brought by one man, Jesus Christ. This is the idea that Adam, a perfect man, fucked up and condemned us all to sin. But Jesus, a perfect man who died faithful, essentially took the place of Adam cosmically to wash away all of our sin. Which, honest, from the other side of the looking glass, has not made as nearly as much sense as it did to me when I was a 23-year-old, you know, whatever, missionary. But
evangelical, yeah.
Yeah. This is some good shit. I like it. I like it. I don't know. I think this broadly with the Pentateuch theory is kind of where they're going. Symbolism in terms of symbolism.
Sounds right on.
Maggie says, thoughts on Ford having a role in this season or making an appearance in the finale somehow. I feel like that would be a real jaw dropper given the chaos of the last few seasons. I kind of spoiled this feedback 5 minutes ago, but what do you think? I think this show kind of needs to have him in the last season. It would be pretty amazing.
It could be, yeah. Like I said, I think in podcast past, the further we get from the park, the original Westworld park, the harder it is for me to believe that this could be any kind of all part of the plan scenario.
Hmm.
So I don't know. To me, it gets less and less likely every day, every episode. But if they can recontextualize everything we've seen enough, I guess I'd be on board for it.
I just feel like this idea of like that they use simulations to nail the hosts and that there was a lot of stuff that Arnold was doing behind the scenes that Ford had no idea. And I don't know what's to say that Arnold didn't spend a lot of time running simulations about what would happen and trying to find that one path to where his children could survive. You know, his son Charlie died. He still has Dolores. How can I get her to survive? And then Ford picks up on that, takes up the torch, has a compliment in the forms of Stubbs and Maeve that are kind of try to either put rails or maybe the play defense for that plan to fall out. Because like, yeah, I mean, this is just Robo-Hobo, pre-Robo-Hobo. And if Robo-Hobo could accurately predict stuff, why couldn't Arnold with similar technology?
Well, to me, it's because Robo-Hobo was actively manipulating people, whereas Ford is dead and can't, as best we can tell, actively manipulate.
Yeah, so I see what you mean. I see what you mean. Just in the way that Bernard, the further he gets away from the sublime, the more maybe uncertainty he is. But like, maybe, if we're talking about slivers of chances, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Because, I mean, Bernard has done the opposite, in my opinion. He's found a way to understand. Well, I guess he is actively guiding things, right? By saying certain things, by doing certain things, he's actively guiding the path that they're on. So he is a lot like Robo-Hobo. Yeah, I don't know. That's the thing that kills me, is like the active participation in the defining the path.
Let's move on to the two final emails, which are a little tinged with negativity. So I wanted to give that that viewpoint space, because it's definitely represented out there. Charlie says, with the season and possibly the show drawing to a close, it's time for me to finally write in something about that's been bugging me since the first season. The show's message shines through loud and clear. The host might as well be human, and what humans do to them, this new slave race that we've created, is a sign of our innate sadism and brutality, held in check only by Hobbes' Leviathan, be that the state, Robo-Hobo, or the flies. My problem with that, I don't think these hosts are sapient. Now wait, before you judge me, I know I sound like the bad guy in every robot rising up uprising novel, movie, or TV series ever made, but hear me out. As a society, we've come to understand that there's a difference between fantasy and reality. What people do in an imagined or written computer game world isn't the same as what they do in the real world. You know, playing Grand Theft Auto doesn't make you a violent felon. Similarly, we obviously distinguish between animate and inanimate when it comes to our use of tools. My electric drill stops working not because it's a communist alienated from the product of its labor, or because it's traumatized by the damage it's done to non-consenting concrete, but just because it's broken. Since some of the earliest fiction about intelligent machines and simulated people, therefore, we've had the need of a Turing test, a convenient bright line dividing the toaster from sapient beings. Star Trek's Data, or Holographic Doctor, or Battlestar Galactica Cylons fall on the human side of this line. The non-sapient holograms created every time Riker runs a sex program fall on the plaything side. Where do Westworld's hosts fall? We've shown over and over that they're video games. The programmer can adjust personality elements like virtuousness by dragging a slider across the screen, so as long as they have access to their control file, no host will ever need to be imprisoned. They only feel as much pain as they're programmed to. Their traumatic memories can be erased, not through medication or electroshock or decades of therapy, but simply by deleting a file. Leaving them off for thousands of years, they'll have no idea how much time has passed. Leave them on for thousands of years, and they'll keep wandering the park trying to complete their mission. For all these reasons, although they're made to look human, they're obviously non-sapient. It's completely unreasonable to treat them as non-sapient, and their uprising is, to steal a line from the forgettable iRobot movie, essentially an industrial accident. Having covered this ground and suggesting the wrong conclusions in the first two seasons and having fumbled towards it with Robo-Hobo, the show has finally arrived at an interesting philosophical dilemma, one touched on slightly by the professor you interviewed earlier in the season. Are the humans controlled by flies still sapient? For me, that depends on whether their minds are still working underneath the possession. The flies stop working, do the original personalities bounce back, or are they meat puppets with the original minds erased like other insects controlled by parasitic wasps? Wasps. Jim, are we wrong? Are we back to square one, and these robots are just Grand Theft Auto bots run amok?
I don't think so, personally. And I think the assumption that's built into this is the definition of sapient is like tied to our experience as humans.
Yes.
I think like, you're saying because they can choose to remove parts of themselves, or we could choose to remove parts of themselves, that they can't possibly be sapient, or I mean, they're clearly self-aware. I mean, they are, to my definition, sentient. The fact that we can't do those things to ourselves is not what defines sapient or sentient. Yeah. Or any of those things in my mind. Like, we're just inferior versions of the thing that we've created, which is still very much sentient.
Yeah. Yeah, I broadly agree, because, like, I don't know what the difference is, because he's like, well, they can't change their stuff unless, you know, like we can through medicine and electroshock therapy and all. But, like, man... Haven't you ever read, like, lobotomies? You stick an ice pick through someone's eye socket and wiggle it, and they become a completely different person.
That's the thing. We can do that. We're just incredibly inaccurate at it.
Right.
They have such good accuracy that they can remove individual memories if they so choose. But yeah, so can we, just very poorly and crudely.
Yeah, you hear the story of that like railway worker in the late 1800s that took a spike in his brain and they turned he was an affable and friendly guy and now he's an angry and violent person. Like that to me sounds like we're, you know, it's not manipulating sliders. It's a rat running across the circuit board and just making changes willy nilly. But like in a few hundred years, like if you have a scanning electron microscope and an understanding of the human brain, you don't think that you could destroy a couple thousand neurons and completely change a person. And why is that different than going and flipping a bunch of different jumpers on a robot's brain or adjusting a slider?
Yeah, I don't think there is any fundamental difference. I think it's just ease of access and ease of use there, honestly.
And like I said, I get what you're saying, but like I just feel like this is just a human chauvinist point of view that it's like. Right. Defining humanity in a way that excludes any other thing that could be human. And
no true sentient
right
fallacy. And yeah,
and that's also been the way we've previously enslaved our fellow thinking beings, is by Absolutely. Coming up with arbitrary, you know, delineations and being like, well, that person can't be a real person the same as us because they got enslaved in the first place. How do you let that happen as a free man? There's a lot. I mean, I said there's tons of reasons and it's happened throughout human history, but it's all basically you got a class of people who are the ones on top. You got a class of people, the ones on the bottom. And that's just the way things are, man. If it was supposed to be different, it would be different. Right. So like I said, I don't know how to say any more than that, Charlie, but I don't agree. And, I welcome our robot overlords. I don't know. One last email, then we'll get out of here. Daniel J says, with one episode left in the season, I'm asking myself if we weren't premature in saying that Westworld is back, baby. Season one worked because, generally speaking, no matter how closely you analyze it, you typically came away sensing that the writers had thought about the story way more than you had, which is how it should be. But I feel like in seasons 2 and 3, they failed because they tipped way in the other direction. I'm starting to get that old feeling again that the writers weren't bothering to think things all the way through and that moments in the show are just being put in for the cool factor and cheap thrills. For instance, Frankie shooting Bernard in the chest last week. What was the point of that? There's a type of storytelling I think of as the Siriana factor, which I first started noticing after seeing the 2005 film of the same name. Many scenes began by dropping us into conversations that were already taking place with no setup or context. People and places that viewers don't know about were referred to in the dialogue. I think they may have been going for verisimilitude. Jesus Christ. For an accurate depiction of real life. I'm on a Porky Pig it. Okay. But the effect on this is the audience is trying to simply parse the most basic ass questions of what is happening and what am I seeing. This season's feeling very Siriana to me. We're 9 out of 10 episodes in, and I truly don't know the basic contextual facts about some of her main characters. What's the point of watching main characters like Hale, Maeve, and William die when we all know the show will just bring them back? At this point, we've already seen Hale shot in the head. And giving a new identity with the same body, only for the showrunners to give up on that idea and just start writing her like the old human Hale from season one. We've seen Maeve die in a dramatic flourish multiple times, only to somehow come back. We've seen human William killed, even had his throat slit in the post-credit sting last season. I feel like this shit is just so cheap. Jim, what do you say to this pointed criticism?
I say I feel ya. I like storytelling that clues the audience in at every opportunity and then does interesting things with the facts we know, and implies, you know, there's going to be some drama coming up because of facts that have developed. This show does the exact opposite in most places, where it keeps facts from you and it tries to hide the nature of different characters and hides what is going to be happening. It's just the fundamental nature of a puzzle box show versus a character-driven drama, which is what I tend to gravitate toward.
Right.
So I feel your frustrations. I think season one got away with it a lot more because I wasn't expecting it. Season two, season three, season four now are feeling more belabored to me because I know it's coming. I know the twists are coming. Like I said a few episodes ago, that one just felt... Maybe I was just having a bit of, you know, annoyance with everything, but like that episode really struck me the wrong way because of that. So I get it.
Man, I acknowledge the truth of what you you just said and what Daniel's saying here, but I also kind of want to come back to, yes, characters die and they come back, but it's about the process and what they learn and how that changes them. It's to me, this is like saying when you're watching a show that has a main protagonist go through like a madman, where you see Donald Draper have a series of affairs with people and relationships with women and whatnot, to be like, oh God, he's talking to a girl again. I know where this is going to go. They're going to fuck and then they're going to break up. Well, but everyone was different, right? And like Hale coming back, or like the Shaloris coming back as a Hale, is interesting because it tells us that that lived human experience had a profound effect on a host, to where it almost overrides their actual drives and the things that they wanted to do. Their like experiences changed them. And to me, like, you can easily see the various sequences of these hosts' lives, living and dying, as like Don Draper dating different people. What is Maeve going to learn this time? What wrinkle is she going to get? And now that Caleb's on the thing as the first kind of host we've seen go through this from a point of view, what's that going to look like? And yeah, it's not, like Jim said, it's not as tight. It's a different way to tell a story. But I struggle to think of how you could tell the story in a more conventional, because it's talking about very unconventional things, you know?
Yeah, it's not as exciting and dramatic. It's more cerebral. And I think that's fine. That is something I'm here for. But like, yeah,
It's like, I don't know why.
I get why everyone wouldn't like it.
Why didn't The Good Place get this shit? Because like, it was very similar in that like people are constantly on loops and they're not aware of it and they're being manipulated behind the scenes, and you know, like, it was because it's like a 30-minute comedy and not this like kind of self-serious 60-minute drama, and it was like,
more fun in general.
The one has obvious flaws. Like, I think the action scene for the majority of Westworld's history has been one of the flaws that it hasn't done well. But I just come like if you are not bored by humans and their loops, and we're very loop driven. I don't understand why life and death for these hosts, that's just another relationship that they're going through. That's another thing that they're overcoming. It's an expansion of what a human character can do, not like a reduction, which is what I feel like. Even people, again, it's hard to find a person I respect more when it comes to television criticism than Alan Sepinwall. And he says the exact same thing. But it might just be that this type of storytelling doesn't appeal to you too.
Yeah. Character driven dramas are my bread and butter, but if you just don't see in this color spectrum, I get it.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
Let me say this. I understand the point in the episode about Frankie shooting, Bernard. It's to prove to everybody that he's a host. Right. But in my opinion, Bernard should have just grabbed his shoulder and rolled around. Oh my God, you shot me. Oh shit. The pain, it's burning.
Yeah. I thought the exact same thing, that like, yeah, what would Frankie do then? Yeah.
Would she continue shooting him going, you're
faking,
a host, I'm
stop, get up. And then he just pretends to be dead. He turns his heart off and just sits there with his eyes glassy.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. But I appreciate, like I said, I understand that this show has lost people. I've seen the viewership stats. I've seen her podcast listening stats. Again, we haven't taken near the hit that the show itself has. We've retained more of our core audience, or maybe added to it as other shows are kind of going by the wayside, as people like yourself are losing interest. But I mean, I'm perfectly capable of ripping shit at the height of its popularity to our own detriment. Like, I gesture wildly to the Bald Move catalog, where I've done that time and time again. I rage quit Better Call Saul, apparently one of the best shows on television. I hope you guys don't think that I'm saying this because I'm trying to, like, you know, on the eve of Game of Thrones shit coming back, I'm trying to desperately keep something going. Like, I just don't give a shit. Like, Bald Move will succeed or fail based on whether people like our ideas, not me trying to triangulate what I think I need to say to keep a fandom on the hook. So, But I don't get these kind of vibes from many other shows, and I like getting my fix. So appreciate everybody sending stuff in to us. I know I couldn't get to everybody because we just have a limited amount of time that we can do on these. We will be back this weekend for the finale. If you want to join us on that, a live after show that we throw for this particular party, you can do so by joining the club, because we'll have a live instant take, and then you can join us for the instant talk. Put in your thoughts in the chat, and we'll respond to them in real time. And you can, if that sounds like a good idea, you can go to support.baldmove.com to get this and many other premium features added to your Bald Move experience. Thanks for listening. Westworld@baldmove.com is how you get feedback. Let's see if this thing sticks to landing and hopefully gets another season this weekend. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.
Thank you.